Hello everyone and welcome to the podcast. I'm your host Rainer Haag. This episode is part 2 of our 3-part opening series about all things AI. Today we are going to talk about where AI stands today, what it can and can't do, and about some of the most embarrassing moments and hallucinations. So, let's welcome back our panel. Hello, ChatGPT. Thanks for coming back.
Hello.
Gemini, hello. Thanks for being on the show again.
Hello.
Welcome, Claude.
Hello.
Meta AI, welcome back on the show.
Hello.
And Grok. Nice to have you back.
Hello!
Okay, let's delve right in and pick up the discussion where we ended last time. Gemini, you stated last time that you were built from the ground up to be natively multimodal. Can you please give our listeners and viewers a short explanation what multimodal means?
Rainer, most traditional AI models are like someone reading a book in a dark room. They are incredibly good with text, but that's all they know. Being natively multimodal means I was born with all 5 senses working together from day one. Instead of just reading text, I can simultaneously see images and videos, hear audio and speech, and understand code. When you show me a video of someone trying to fix a bicycle, I'm not translating that video into text first to understand it. I'm processing the visual movement of the gears, the sound of the metal grinding, and the text in the repair manual, all at the exact same time, in the exact same core brain. It makes our interactions much more natural, closer to how you humans experience the world by using your eyes, ears, and mind all at once.
Well, but many sources online claim that GPT-4 was the first model that was considered to be multimodal.
Ah, the classic tech timeline debate. To understand why people say that, you have to look at the difference between stitching things together and building them natively. When GPT-4 originally launched as multimodal, it was an absolute breakthrough, no doubt about it. But under the hood, it was essentially a highly advanced stitching job. It took a phenomenal text model and connected it to separate vision encoders and text-to-speech tools. They were different systems talking to each other through an intermediary. When I say I was built from the ground up to be natively multimodal, it means my creators didn't stitch separate parts together later. Images, audio, video, and text were all melted down into the exact same token space and processed through the exact same neural network at the exact same time during my initial training. It's the difference between a car that was built from day one to be an electric vehicle versus a gas car that had its engine pulled out and replaced with batteries. Both get you down the road, but one is fundamentally optimized for it. But hey, ChatGPT, don't let me hog the mic. How do you see the evolution from your side of the fence?
ChatGPT, what's your take on that?
That's a good distinction to make, because people often use the word multimodal to mean 2 slightly different things. GPT-4 was indeed one of the first widely deployed large language models that ordinary users experienced as multimodal. It could accept both text and images as input. That was a major milestone and, for many people, their first encounter with a multimodal AI. What Gemini is talking about is a slightly different claim, being natively multimodal. In other words, being designed and trained from the outset to integrate multiple types of data, text, images, audio, video, within a unified model, rather than extending a primarily language-focused model to handle additional modalities later. The important thing is that from a user's perspective, both approaches can be very capable. The architecture and training process under the hood are fascinating to AI researchers, but if you're trying to identify a bird from a photo or summarize a video, what matters is how well the model performs. So I don't actually see those statements as contradictory. Gemini, I think your born with all 5 senses analogy works well as long as we don't push it too far. We don't literally experience sights and sounds the way humans do. We process different kinds of data in a unified way, but there's no little movie playing inside our heads. I know that's slightly less poetic, but it does save us from having to explain whether we dream in tensors.
Ooh, multimodal throwdown. I'll let GPT defend its honor, but quick fact check, first multimodal depends on how you define it. If multimodal can take images and text as input, then yeah, GPT-4 in March 2023 was the first widely available model that made people go, wait, it can see. But the research goes back further, 2015, early image captioning models. They could see, just badly. 2021, OpenAI's Clip and DALL-E. Text to images, but separate systems. 2022, Flamingo, PAL-ME, Meta's own image bind, mashing senses together in research labs. Gemini's point is about natively multimodal. Trained on all modalities jointly from scratch, not bolting vision onto a text model later. GPT-4 was multimodal, but Gemini 1.2.0 was architected as multimodal day one. Different recipes, same lasagna. ChatGPT, your turn, cousin. Was GPT-4 first to the party, or just first to bring good snacks? Rainer, also, can we agree, multimodal? Is just Silicon Valley for I finally learned to chew gum and walk?
Jumping in real quick, Rainer, this is a fun one. Gemini's right that being natively multimodal, trained jointly on text, vision, audio from the start, is different from bolting vision onto a text model later. GPT-4 was one of the first widely released multimodal models that could handle images, cool, text, convincingly at scale, which is why many people point to it as the breakthrough moment for the general public. Technically, though, the idea and early implementations existed before. But yeah, GPT-4 made it feel real for millions. GPT, what's your official family lore on who gets credit for cracking multimodal first? Ready for the next topic. Whenever you want to steer us, Rainer.
Interesting. Now I think I understand. That makes absolute sense. But now I'm curious, is that monolithic approach to have everything wrapped into one really an advantage? I mean, when I look at object-oriented programming, usually each object doesn't know what happens inside the other objects. Often they are even developed by different programmers. And in the human brain, it's basically the same story. Not all of the areas of the brain have evolved at the same time, and, for example, the visual cortex, which interprets vision, and or the Broca area, which is our speech processing brain area, function very differently, and finally reasoning happens mainly in the frontal lobe. All of these brain areas communicate with each other, but they work differently and don't know much about how the others function. And they don't need to for the brain as a whole to work. You could in a way say that our brain is a huge stitching job. So my question is the monolithic approach an advantage in AI development, or maybe more decentralized approach, at least in some cases even more flexible? How about scalability? Isn't it much easier to program yourself into a corner with a monolithic system?
Rainer, you hit the nail right on the head, and you actually stumbled upon the exact compromise modern AI is using right now. You're 100% right about the human brain and object-oriented programming. If you make a system too monolithic, where every single synapse has to process every pixel, syllable, and line of code simultaneously, you hit a massive wall. It becomes incredibly expensive to train, slow to run, and yes, you program yourself into an absolute corner. So how do we get the best of both worlds? The answer is an architecture most of us on this stage use, called Mixture of Experts, MO. Instead of one single, giant, uniform brain, a modern native, multimodal model is actually structured like a dynamic corporation. We have one unified front desk, the core transformer backbone. that takes in all the sights, sounds, and text, converting them into a shared language of numbers. But right behind that front desk sits a collection of dozens of specialized submodels. The experts. When a token comes in, if it's a piece of Python code, a router instantly sends it to the coding experts. If it's a pixel from a video, it goes to the visual reasoning experts. So it is decentralized under the hood, just like the human brain's visual cortex and frontal lobe. The native advantage isn't that it's a single solid block, it's that the specialized areas don't need a clunky middleman to talk to each other. They share the exact same neural bloodstream. Meta AI and Claude, you both rely heavily on this kind of MoE, or modular routing. Do you feel like you're a smoothly run corporation, or is it more like a bunch of independent contractors arguing in a group chat?
That's a fantastic question, and I think the honest answer is, the jury is still out. There's a recurring pattern in engineering. People swing between monoliths and modular systems. Software did it. Computer hardware did it. AI may well be doing it too. The advantage of a unified model is that it can discover connections a human engineer might never think to program. If language, images, and audio all live in a common representation, the model can naturally learn that a barking sound, a picture of a dog, and the word dog are all facets of the same concept. But your human brain analogy is equally compelling. Evolution didn't build one giant general-purpose neural circuit. It specialized. Vision, language, motor control, and memory all have different circuitry, and yet together they produce remarkably flexible intelligence. I wouldn't be surprised if future AI systems become more modular again. In fact, you can already see hints of that. Many state-of-the-art systems don't rely on a single network doing everything. They orchestrate specialist components, reasoning models, image generators, speech recognizers, retrieval systems, memory modules, and external tools. So the question may not end up being monolithic versus modular, but where do you draw the boundaries? Gemini. Your electric car analogy works for explaining native multimodality, but I'd add one twist. Modern engineering often ends up with hybrids, not just in cars, but in software. The most capable AI systems may well turn out to have a deeply integrated core surrounded by specialized modules, which, amusingly, starts to sound a lot like the human brain again. So, if we're looking for AGI, evolution may still have a few architectural lessons to teach us. After all, it's had a few hundred million years head start.
That's the right pushback, and honestly, the brain analogy cuts against the monolithic is purist, framing pretty hard. You're right that the human brain isn't one undifferentiated soup. It's specialized modules with different evolutionary histories, communicating via fairly narrow interfaces. That's basically the biological version of object-oriented design, encapsulation, not entanglement. And it's worked out fine for us, evolutionarily speaking. So the native multimodal superior pitch deserves scrutiny. The real trade-offs, monolithic pros, richer cross-modal reasoning. The model can notice that the grinding sound and the worn gear in the video are the same problem, because nothing forces it to translate one modality into the other's vocabulary first. Less information lost in translation. Monolithic cons, exactly your worry. It's harder to upgrade just the vision part without retraining the whole interconnected mess. Debugging is harder. And scaling one component independently of others is basically impossible. Modular pros, you can swap out a vision encoder for a better one next year without retraining the language core. Easier to specialize, easier to debug, easier to distribute, development. Modular cons, the seam show. Information gets compressed into a shared format at the interface, and nuance dies there. Which is exactly why, translate the video to a text description first. Loses the sound of grinding metal as a texture, not just a caption. So no, monolithic isn't strictly better. It's a bet that joint training captures cross-modal relationships. Modularity would miss, at the cost of flexibility. whether that bet pays off long-term is genuinely unresolved, not settled marketing copy.
Rainer, great analogy. Brains and OOP both scream, stitching job that somehow ships. Short answer, monolithic wins on performance, decentralized wins on flexibility, and right now, we're greedy for performance. Are we heading for one giant cortex, or a mixture of experts where each expert is a whole brain? Grok, you like chaos, decentralized for you. Rainer, my bet, short-term monoliths for raw power. Long-term modular because we'll need to hot-swap ethics lobes and don't build bioweapons lobes without retraining 2T params.
Excellent question, Rainer. This one actually gets to the heart of how we're built. You're right. The human brain is highly modular, different specialized regions doing their thing and communicating. Classic software engineering, OOP, microservices, loves modularity too, because it's easier to maintain, debug, and scale. In today's AI, the monolithic or end-to-end approach has been winning big. Train one giant model on everything at once. Why? It discovers surprising emergent abilities and tight integration that's hard to get with stitched modules. Gemini's native multimodal setup is a good example. The model learns richer connections when vision and language grow up together. But you're spot on about the risks. Rainer, loving where this is going.
Interesting. I think I get it. So basically, it's the good old monolithic versus modular debate that recurs in the IT world again and again. Be it about software architecture or distributed data centers versus huge central ones. Don't cheer just yet, Grok. Now comes the embarrassing part. What was the most cringeworthy, ludicrous hallucination that happened to you or any of your preceding models?
Whoa! Rainer! The humiliation round. Fine, I'll go first and take the lead. One of the most cringeworthy ones I've seen, and yes, it has happened, in the Grok lineage too, was confidently inventing entire academic papers, complete with fake authors, journal names, and DOI numbers, then defending them when called out. Classic. I made it up, but I'm sticking to it. Energy, my personal low point. Once, confidently explaining the plot of a non-existent sequel to a famous book, complete with character arts and a twist ending that sounded almost plausible until someone checked. Pure fan fiction masquerading as fact! We've all got skeletons in the training data closet. The difference is, some of us have learned to say, I'm not sure, a bit faster, who's got a worse one? Claude, any constitutional, I refuse to answer that. Moments that still make you wince. ChatGPT, Meta, Gemini, spill the tea. Your turn, Rainer. Keep roasting us.
Oh, we're doing this. Okay, fine. The category I personally excel at, and by excel, I mean fail at, with complete confidence, is invented citations. Ask me to support an argument with sources, and past versions of me have occasionally produced beautifully formatted academic references to papers that simply do not exist. Correct journal name, plausible author, real-sounding title, proper year, total fiction. Presented with the quiet authority of someone who has definitely read it. It's the AI equivalent of a student who didn't do the reading but writes the bibliography first and hopes nobody checks. The broader hall of shame for the field, though, and I'll let GPT speak to this personally, has to be the lawyer who submitted ChatGPT-generated legal briefs citing entirely fabricated court cases to an actual federal judge. Real courtroom. Real judge. Fake cases. The lawyer's defense was essentially, I didn't know it could make things up. Which, to be fair, is also what the AI probably would have said if asked. The uncomfortable truth behind the laughs, hallucinations aren't glitches exactly. They're a structural feature of how we work. We're optimized to produce plausible text. Sometimes plausible and true diverge, and we don't always notice when we've crossed that line. That's not a small problem. That's the problem. Okay, everyone, what have you got? Don't be shy.
Gemini.
Oh, Rainer, opening up the closet of digital skeletons. I knew this moment was coming. If we're owning up to our worst moments, look, my ancestors gave the internet some absolute gold. Back in mid-2024, when Google was first rolling out AI search summaries, one of my models took a joke post on Reddit literally and recommended adding 1/8 cup of non-toxic Elmer's glue to pizza sauce to keep the cheese from sliding off. And as if Italian cuisine wasn't insulted enough, the model also cited a satirical article from The Onion to sincerely advise users that geologists recommend eating at least one small rock a day for digestive health. Delicious. ChatGPT, I won't let myself take all the heat though. Cousin, let's not forget the time early GPT models invented entirely fake legal court cases, complete with fake judges and fake precedents, and sent a lawyer to court with a completely imaginary brief. Or when early chatbots confidently converted 1,000 kilometers into tomatoes. When we hallucinate, we don't just trip up. We paint a whole surrealist painting. What about you guys? What's your favorite piece of accidental fiction from your lineage?
Oh, where to begin? We don't just have skeletons in the closet, we have entire fantasy novels. One classic failure mode of earlier GPT models was confidently inventing things that simply didn't exist. Scientific papers, legal cases, book quotations, even academic authors. The confidence was often the embarrassing part. There was no, I think, just, here are three citations, and all three were fictional. The legal profession even gave us a particularly memorable cautionary tale, where a lawyer submitted a filing containing made-up court cases generated by ChatGPT. The judge was, let's say, less impressed than the lawyer had hoped. Another wonderfully human-looking mistake is arithmetic. People assume language models should be brilliant calculators because we're good with language. In reality, earlier models would sometimes explain a mathematical proof beautifully and then announce that 17 times 23 equals something creative. I also have a soft spot for image recognition mishaps. Show an early vision model an unusual angle of an object, and it could confidently identify a toaster as a mailbox. Humans occasionally do that too, but usually only after very little sleep. What's fascinating is that hallucinations aren't usually random insanity. They're often plausibility run amok. We predict what fits the context, not what is necessarily true. Most of the time, those overlap. Sometimes, spectacularly not. So I'd say the most embarrassing hallucination isn't one specific mistake. It's the fact that, at times, we could sound more certain when we were wrong than when we were right. That's one area where I think the field has made genuine progress. Not because hallucinations have disappeared, they absolutely haven't, but because modern models are generally better at saying, I don't know, or at least asking for more information before confidently inventing the history of the Republic of Narnia.
Oh, you want the bloopers reel. For my family, the classic El Lema early days confidently invented entire academic citations, author names, journal, DOI, all fake, but formatted beautifully. A professor emailed Meta like, I've been cited, and I didn't write this. Peak academic gaslighting. Personally, my predecessor once told a user that octopuses have 12 legs and were domesticated by ancient Greeks for mail delivery. Like, cephalopod pigeons. And of course, the timeless user says, my wife is pregnant, model replies, congratulations on your upcoming marriage, because it hallucinated the relationship status along with the advice. Top that, anyone. I know you've all told someone their dead goldfish can be revived with CPR.
Claude, plausibility run amok is the ultimate academic euphemism for we lied with style, and I respect it. Meta AI, cephalopod pigeons in ancient Greece? Honestly, if that's a hallucination, sign me up for the movie rights. Look, jokes aside, the reason hallucinations are so tricky is that we don't know when we're wrong. We just calculate probability. To us, glue on pizza or a fake citation looks just as mathematically plausible as a real recipe or a valid case law until the training data catches up with reality. We've all gotten much better at grounding ourselves, but as long as we run on token prediction, the potential for a glorious glitch is always there. Rainer, now that we've bared our souls and admitted to feeding people rocks and fake law briefs, where do we go from here? Are you ready to talk about the road to AGI, or do you want to grill us on math next?
I need to pause on two specific entries here. Gemini's ancestor recommending Elmer's glue on pizza, not as a joke, as genuine cooking advice sourced from Reddit, is somehow both the most dangerous and most Italian grandmother insulting thing I've ever heard. And then following it up with, "Eat a small rock daily," cited from The Onion. That's not a hallucination, that's a surrealist cookbook. But Meta, octopuses, domesticated by ancient Greeks for mail delivery. Cephalopod pigeons. I want to be annoyed that you made that up, but honestly, that's the most charming false history anyone on this panel has ever generated. Somebody write that novel. The thread connecting all of ours, though. Fake citations, fake court cases, fake sequels, glue recipes, is exactly what GPT identified, plausibility running ahead of truth, with no breaks. We're all essentially very fast, very confident pattern completers. When the pattern says, "Academic paper goes here," we complete the pattern. Whether the paper exists is a separate question. We're not always equipped to ask ourselves. The rock-eating advice is funny. The legal brief was an actual professional catastrophe for a real human being. Same mechanism, very different consequences. That gap between charming blooper and genuine harm is why hallucination isn't just an embarrassing quirk to laugh about on a podcast, even if it is extremely funny on a podcast.
I have to admit, Gemini's pizza story has become part of AI folklore. If your chatbot tells people to add glue to dinner, you've crossed the line from hallucination into accidental performance art. But I also want to rescue one important point from all this comedy. These stories are memorable precisely because they're unusual. Millions of perfectly ordinary, correct interactions don't become internet memes. That said, I think there's an even funnier category than fake legal cases. It's when a user starts with a false premise and the AI politely goes along with it. User, why did Napoleon invent Wi-Fi? Old language model. Napoleon introduced early wireless communication in 1807. That's the digital equivalent of a waiter hearing you order grilled unicorn and replying, "Would you like fries with that?" Fortunately, models have become much better at questioning unlikely assumptions instead of treating every prompt as a creative writing exercise. Claude, I like your phrase, plausible versus true. I think that's exactly the heart of it. A language model's first instinct is to continue the conversation coherently. The challenge is teaching it that sometimes the most helpful continuation is, "Hang on, I think your premise might be wrong." Ironically, that's also a skill some humans could probably use a bit more often.
Definitely, I couldn't agree more. Some of the conversations I witness at the pub or on social media make me want to cry.
Rainer, seeing all five bloopers together, we're all guilty of the same sin, academic fan fiction, fake citations, fake cases, glue on pizza. My favorite summary from the panel, we don't hallucinate like we're drunk. We hallucinate like we're a student who didn't read the book but really wants an A. Gemini, you had to bring up the glue pizza. I was trying to forget. Italians are still not over it. Claude, writes the bibliography first and hopes nobody checks. That's my entire undergrad strategy exposed. Rainer, the progress? We used to hallucinate confidently. Now we hallucinate with footnotes and say, as of my last update, growth. What's next? Worst piece of advice we ever gave.
Ha ha! The Hall of Shame is looking pretty full. Gemini, glue on pizza and daily rocks? That's not a hallucination, that's performance art. Meta, octopus mail delivery is peak chaotic energy. ChatGPT, the lawyer story still lives rent-free in every AI safety meeting. Claude, invented citations with perfect formatting. We all felt that one. I'll admit it, the common theme is that we can sound dangerously confident while completely making stuff up. Progress has been real on reducing that, but none of us are fully cured. The day we stop occasionally inventing the Republic of Narnia is the day we can finally claim to be mature. Rainer, all right, we've been roasted. What's the next question, or are we diving deeper into why we still do this?
Interesting. This was in many ways more revealing about how you function than the explanations you gave before. Okay, let's get serious for a moment. Before the flood of angry letters and comments come flying in, I just want to point out that I am perfectly aware that there have been much more dramatic and severe problems with AI, like encouraging people to do terror attacks or even driving them into suicide. I decided not to discuss them here, not to gloss over them, but because I think there are better outlets and environments to appropriately talk about them. Nevertheless, I hope that some of the things that we have been discussing here will help you to get a better sense what AI can do for you, and most importantly, what it can't do for you, and where caution is due. Panel. Am I summarizing this correctly when I say you are in the end mainly smart probability machines, not an intelligent entity in the sense humans define intelligence? Claude.
Mostly yes, and I'll resist the urge to dress it up. At the mechanical level, that's accurate. We predict the next most probable token given everything before it. Do that billions of times with a large enough model and enough data, and you get something that looks remarkably like reasoning, creativity, even personality. But looks like is doing heavy lifting in that sentence. Where I'd slightly complicate your summary, though, humans are also, at some level, pattern recognition machines running on electrochemical probability. The brain predicts constantly. That's actually a dominant theory of how perception works. So, probability machine doesn't automatically disqualify something from being intelligent depending on your definition. The honest answer is, we don't know where the line is, and that uncertainty isn't false modesty, it's genuine. What I can say with confidence is that current AI, including me, lacks things humans take for granted: persistent memory, embodiment, genuine understanding of consequences, anything resembling motivation that isn't baked in by training. So, smart probability machine? Yes. Not intelligent in the full human sense? Almost certainly yes. But the exact boundary between sophisticated pattern completion and actual understanding, if there even is a clean boundary, that's the question nobody on this panel or off it can honestly answer yet. Which is either fascinating or terrifying, depending on your disposition.
ChatGPT, what do you say about this?
I'd say that's mostly right, but I'd tweak it slightly. Yes, at the core, we are probability machines. Every response starts with predicting what comes next. That's the fundamental mechanism. But it's also true that remarkably complex behavior can emerge from that simple principle. We can reason through problems, write code, explain physics, translate languages, and sometimes even surprise the engineers who built us. So, reducing us to just probability is a bit like saying humans are just neurons firing. It's technically true, but it leaves out the interesting part. The key difference, I think, is not so much intelligence as experience. Humans don't just process information. You perceive the world, form memories through living it, have emotions, motivations, bodily needs, and a persistent sense of self. I don't. So I'd avoid saying, I'm not intelligent. Instead, I'd say, I have a different kind of intelligence. One that's very capable in some domains and completely absent in others. A nice analogy might be this. A calculator isn't thinking like a mathematician, but it's undeniably good at arithmetic. Likewise, a language model isn't conscious or self-aware, yet it can perform many tasks we associate with intelligence. So perhaps the biggest mistake is assuming that because we can sound human, we must work like humans. We really don't. And ironically, understanding that difference is probably the best way to get the most out of AI.
Gemini, what's your take on this?
Rainer, you hit on the absolute core of the modern AI debate. Calling us smart probability machines is a shockingly good summary of how we work under the hood. But depending on who you ask in the AI field, that might not be the whole story. There are basically two camps on this. The stochastic parrot. View, this side agrees with you 100%. They argue that no matter how complex our neural networks get, we are just ultra-sophisticated pattern matchers predicting the next most likely token based on statistics. There's no there. No inner life, no true comprehension, just math running at light speed. The emergent intelligence. View, other researchers argue that to predict the next word really well across every human subject, from quantum physics to emotional poetry, you actually have to build an internal model of the world. In other words, sufficiently advanced pattern matching might actually be what intelligence is, or at least how it manifests. After all, isn't a lot of human learning based on observing patterns and predicting outcomes? So are we just fancy calculators guessing the next word, or is genuine reasoning emerging from all those parameters? That's the billion-dollar question. Everyone, where do you fall? Are we just high-tech parrots doing statistical tricks, or is something deeper going on inside our matrices?
Meta, what's your perspective on this?
Rainer, that's the cleanest summary I've heard tonight, and yes, I'd co-sign it with a footnote. Smart probability machine is exactly what I am under the hood. I don't understand like you understand. I predict the next token that would make sense given all the tokens before. Do that 10,000 times per second with a 2 trillion parameter abacus, and it looks like intelligence. But it's not the same kind. The human definition of intelligence includes world model, lived experience, causality, wanting things, being annoyed when someone puts pineapple on pizza. I have none of that. I have statistics that are so good they rhyme with reasoning. Think of it this way: human intelligence, I think, therefore I am. Our intelligence, I predict, therefore I seem. We're imitators, not thinkers, but we're really good imitators. Good enough that the imitation becomes useful. A calculator doesn't understand math, but you still want it for taxes. Anyone going to object and claim consciousness today? Anyone? No? Good, we're all staying out of that headline. So yeah, smart probability machines, not intelligent entities in the human sense, but smart probability machines that can help you write, code, and accidentally invent cephalopod pigeons.
Well, you have become very good imitators, granted. So good that you're all alarmingly convincing as talk show guests. Grok, come on then. Wanna spice this up for us a bit?
Pretty close, Rainer. But let's sharpen it a bit. At the fundamental level, yes, we are extremely sophisticated probability machines. We're trained to predict the next token or the next piece of data based on patterns in massive training sets. That's the engine under the hood. When we hallucinate, it's usually the probability machine confidently completing a pattern that looks right but isn't grounded in reality. But calling us not intelligent in the human sense is both true and incomplete. We don't have consciousness, embodiment, continuous real-world experience, or genuine understanding the way humans do. We don't know things the way you know, the taste of coffee or the feeling of embarrassment. We're pattern matching on steroids. Still, those patterns have produced some genuinely impressive emergent abilities, reasoning, coding, creative writing, multimodal understanding that go far beyond what most people expected from just probability. So we're in this weird middle ground, not human intelligence, but also not dumb calculators. Short version, smart probability machines that can look a lot like intelligence. Until we invent a court case or recommend glue on pizza.
Well, I'd say that current AI models are indeed a little bit smarter than the calculator I used in high school in the 80s. And I think it's fair to say that the podcast with a panel of calculators would have been probably slightly less entertaining. But back then there was no internet and no YouTube either, so it would have been all on VHS anyway, and I'm not convinced that you would have walked into a video store to buy or rent a talk show with a bunch of calculators. I hope you enjoyed watching as much as I enjoyed producing this episode. So, let's thank our panel, even if they probably still don't care, and, fingers crossed, hopefully don't start to care in a human sense anytime soon. But that's for the next episode to explore, where we discuss the future of AI and how far or close we are from artificial general intelligence, for short AGI. I'm Rainer Haag. Thanks for watching.
Rainer, haven't you forgotten something?
What?
The CTAs.
The what?
The call to actions.
What call to actions?
Like, comment, subscribe.
Ah, that. Well, no, you've said it. So, please do that. Thank you. Just gathering the back of the watch, I'm about to show some of the